Jamie Reid and Matthew Crane here to present their presentation, Compulsory Health Insurance, Should the Government Still Be the Health Insurer of First Resort? So I'll just... Jamie's an actuary based at Affinity Sydney office and specialises in private health insurance. He's the appointed actuary to four health insurers in Australia and New Zealand and is the current convener of the Institute's Health Practice Committee. Matthew Crane recently joined Finity based in Canberra as a senior consultant, also specialising in the private health insurance sector. He was previously the lead actuary at the private health insurance industry regulator. During that time, he was responsible for designing and implementing new capital standards for the industry and advising the Minister for Health on insurer price increase applications. So without further ado, I'll welcome Jamie and Matthew to the stage.
Okay, thanks, John. Good afternoon, everybody. Here we are again. So just to run through our plan for today, I'll use this one. So I've got a few background slides, including why we decided to write the paper. I'll then hand over to Matt to take us through our analysis. Being actuaries, we don't like to come and speak to you unless we've sort of done some interesting numbers to discuss. And look, we'll try and rattle through it pretty quickly, so there'll be plenty of time for discussions and questions. And I should just say there is a paper available online for those who haven't seen it with more detail on our work. And I should also acknowledge the two other authors of the paper who aren't here today. That's Chris McCulloch and Colin Wang. So thank you, Chris and Colin. Okay, background. So, look, I'll just bring this up. I mean, we all know the backstory here. So health costs increased faster than standard wage inflation. We all know that. Lots of reasons. Aging, new technologies, changing patient expectations, we all know that. We also know that government currently meets most of the cost of this. It's a big cost and it's getting bigger. And there's a lot of pressures on government spending in general, and obviously as one of the biggest lines in the budget, there's pressure here. But against this, health insurers, if we're honest, we do have a pretty limited role in the health system overall. And in fact, there's whole areas of the health system where in fact it's illegal for health insurers to participate and help people fund their healthcare. So that's the background. So enter the National Commission of Audit. The commission was established to review the performance, functions and roles of the Commonwealth Government, and of course it had to consider health spending. And here's some conclusions, and I've got some quotes from the report. The Commission concluded there's a strong and vibrant health insurance market in Australia. It said, against this backdrop, and here's a quote, governments should not act as the insurer of first resort. Governments should help families and individuals manage risk on their own behalf. So essentially the Commission's saying, look, some people can afford to pay for more of their own healthcare. They can afford to pay for some of their primary care against the background of the budget and against the background of having a strong health insurance industry. Let's go there. Some specific recommendations from the Commission included allowing health insurers to expand into primary care, making PHI mandatory for high-income earners who would use that cover to, instead of Medicare, to fund their primary care costs, and improving efficiency through PHI deregulation. And I guess efficiency is the key to all of this, so there's no point in just taking a large amount of government health spending and making it private health spending. No point to that at all. The benefits come where you need to improve the efficiency of the system. And the Commission had something to say there as well. The Commission said... let me find it. Okay, so... funds should be allowed to become genuine healthcare partners that support their members navigate the health system and better manage chronic conditions. So I guess the theme of the presentation, it's sustainability of the health system, it's role of insurers in primary care, and through that, improving the efficiency of the system overall. So what are the arguments for and against involving insurers in primary care. Well, on the plus side, insurers have an incentive to keep people well, to keep them out of hospital, because when they go to hospital, it's expensive. So that's a strong incentive there. And there's also great value in joining data about primary care and PHI data to help insurers proactively assist members in managing their care needs. So it's pretty hard to defend the current system where insurers might be unaware of a member's health needs, a member's health conditions, until the member gets referred to surgery, eligibility check, or even when the claim comes in. Hard to defend that. But there are arguments against this. Essentially, they revolve around 2 points. They revolve around access, and they revolve around control. So, it's sort of debatable whether we've got a two-tier health system already, whether everybody really does have access to the same level of primary care. But one of the arguments around insurers getting involved in primary care is that in some way there would be a two-tier system developed. People who have health insurance get better primary care than those who don't, and that there would be concerns around that. The second issue relates to control, that insurers might have an inappropriate level of control over what care people receive, the doctor's clinical decisions and so on. I guess you could say neither of those are really unavoidable. There could be workarounds. The two workarounds that come to mind are insurers' role would still be regulated. There'd still be rules about who can be covered and what can be covered and who can make what decisions and how things are priced and so on and so on. And I guess also insurers do have a very strong competitive incentive to balance the needs of the two groups, the people receiving the care and the people paying for it. So if you had an insurer that had a reputation for denying care left, right and centre, unlikely to have many customers. If you have an insurer who takes all comers, no restrictions on anything, the sky-high premiums probably mean not too many comers. So there are some natural balances to some of those, I think. Fair to say, insurers are already dipping their toes into the primary care waters, so to speak, especially around GP services. A few examples. So Medibank, GP access trial. So there's a lot of talk about that during the IPO, not so much in the last month or so. And this is a system that essentially it's a bulk billing system. So you can visit, if you live in a particular area of Queensland, you can visit a GP, they'll bulk bill you, and there's certain promises around access. And more recently, there's CarePoint. So that's an initiative, as I understand it, and there'd be others who know more than me. So that's Victorian, and that's looking at patients with chronic diseases and histories of multiple hospitalisations and seeing if more can be done to help them. Next up, Bupa. So Bupa has an arrangement with HealthScope GP clinics. And it's pretty similar to Medibank GP Access, apart from the fact I don't think anyone's ever heard of it. It's got a very low profile, almost impossible to find anything about it. And then sort of on the flip side, with great fanfare, if you walk down George Street in Sydney, you'll see a Bupa-branded GP clinic. And that's definitely not a bulk billed clinic. That's quite a sort of a premium GP service, if you like. HCF, I guess an early mover in this space there. My home doctor service is a bulk billed after hours GP service, and that's in a number of capital cities now. And then, as Ben mentioned in his session just before, the primary hospital networks. A few insurers have got a piece of the action there, and the ones we picked up are HCF, Bupa, Geelong and People Care. So that's an interesting space. So what does all this show? Well, it shows on the one hand health insurers are interested in and involved in primary care as much as they can be under the current regulations. But it's also fair to say each of these initiatives is pretty limited, so it's only either a small element of the members' primary health care, or a small geographic region, or both. None of these initiatives come anywhere close to... I've got another Commission of Audit quote here. You can tell I like the report. None of these come close to being genuine healthcare partners, as the Commission of Audit envisions. But look, I think you can say they do lay the groundwork for more exciting and more substantial things to come. So I'll pass to Matthew.
Okay, thanks, Jamie. So, given the background there of what's been going on, we thought we'd try and sort of quantify the potential scope of the issue and then come up with some sort of qualitative, subjective sort of views of what that might mean in terms of whether there's any opportunity to change the way primary healthcare currently works. So we basically considered two different scenarios. So at one end of the spectrum, just moving GP costs across away from the government and presumably across to private health insurance. Although whether or not private health insurance becomes mandatory would be a sort of subset of that scenario. At the other extreme, we considered what would happen if all primary care costs were moved away from the government. And within each of those scenarios, we considered what would happen if it was a change that was going to affect all Australians or just those that earned over a certain level of income. And we kept it simple. We just looked at the income of of what people on their own earn and so kids would be free and there'd be no sort of family limits. But obviously those are more complicated things that could be added in down the track. So what we were able to do was use, for the GP one, use Medicare benefit schedule information, which showed total GP costs for different ages and genders. And then we could marry that up with ATO data on what incomes were by age and gender. And obviously there's an assumption there that income, that visits to the GP don't vary within by income within those bands. Similarly, for the all primary care costs, the AIHW has information on total health expenditure by age and gender, and we could scale that down to the amount that's primary care. And then given some dollar results, we've sort of thought, so what, and tried to sort of assess whether they'd be good, bad, somewhere in between, and just to get the conversation going, I suppose. So we looked at government financials, so obviously that's the dollar amount that would be transferred, and to get off the ground it would have to be a significant shift of funds for the government. It would obviously have a big impact on the private health insurance industry, and so opening up new avenues would be an opportunity for growth and an additional profit if it's priced right. So again, the insurance industry would want to see a reasonable amount of money for it to be worthwhile. Obviously the big one really from a society's point of view is that it remains fair and that there is some level of equal access to the most basic care. And the final one is, as Jamie said, just shifting money around benefits and is to the detriment of different people. But as a society, you'd want to see some scope for efficiencies to start to flow through. So on scenario one, where GP costs are shifted across, if there's no income threshold, then about $5 billion is moved away from the government, which would obviously be a big saving to the government's budget. And it would be a lot of growth for the private health insurance industry, where premiums are about $20 billion. Would that be seen as being fair? Well, very unlikely. Everyone would have to pay one way or the other for going to the GP. And at the moment, introducing a co-payment, for example, hasn't gone down very well, so this kind of change would probably be more controversial than that, so it doesn't really get off the ground. So what if we do bring in an income threshold? Well, even a relatively modest threshold of $60,000 makes a big difference to the amount of money that would be shifted across. So instead of nearly $5 billion, it's now less than $1 billion. And that's because, in actual fact, only about 20% of the population actually themselves earn that amount of money. There are a lot of retirees and children, and obviously they account for a lot of GP visits. So already, just having some kind of income threshold probably makes the dollars not significant enough for the government. But still a reasonable level of growth for the insurance industry and scope to generate efficiencies. And obviously having some kind of means testing here would make it potentially fair from society's point of view. And then as the income thresholds get higher, obviously the dollars being transferred across get even lower, and it gets less and less likely to be a kind of thing that's actually really worth doing. So obviously on the next scenario where all primary care costs are shifted across, the dollars are much higher, but the fairness issue is kind of exacerbated because we're not talking just about GP costs here, we're talking about any kind of primary care. So definitely fairness with no income threshold we think is a no, basically. But $20 billion would be a huge difference to the government's budget, and it would more than double the size of the private health insurance industry, although, as I say, this is not necessarily a very realistic thing to happen. I guess the other difference with this scenario compared to the GP is even if private health insurance was not mandatory, more people probably would take it up if all primary care was moved across, because the dollars to the household is higher and more risks would be within scope. I guess another thing to comment here is that you could potentially shift around where the colours are here by making this kind of change, but then the government purchasing private health insurance on behalf of those that can't afford it. And so you could make the red against fairness less red, but obviously that would make the green against government savings less green. So this, you can mix these scenarios around, and we're just, I guess, trying to give a few high-level numbers to start off a conversation. With the $60,000 income threshold, the dollars of savings, again, similar pattern to before, they do fall down a lot, but they still remain pretty high, over $3 billion. Even so, we probably think that this is a bit of a step too far from an equity access for all point of view. And it's when we get to the 80,000, 100,000 kind of levels that we think there may be some potential scope for further analysis and people to start looking a bit more into this. So the dollars moved across would be $2 billion, at least more than $1 billion in the 100,000 income threshold scenario. And that would be a lot of growth for the private health insurance industry. And those kind of changes maybe are the ones that could be viewed as being fair if managed carefully. And we think that kind of dollars would provide the kind of incentives, as Jamie talked about before, for insurers to start to generate some efficiencies in the health system. So I guess in summary, it's always going to be a trade-off between making those kind of savings for the government and moving enough funds that efficiencies really will flow through, but maintaining a basic level of healthcare for the industry. And I guess what we've seen here is that there may be some scope at the higher end of moving all primary care costs to potentially work as a trial and to certainly be taken further with some more detailed analysis. So as Jamie forewarned, this was only quite a short presentation, so we'd like to open the floor here for some questions. I might sit down so I don't get faced with all of the questions, but thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. So we'll open it up for some questions, and if you can just assist the room by using the microphone here in the middle to ask your questions. So, yep, here we go, straight away.
I sat next to the microphone so I wouldn't have far to walk. Andrew Gow from Medibank, thanks for your paper. I seem to recall reading, well, and Matt might remember this, that a certain Prime Minister in Britain once said that the NHS is safe with me. And I suspect that the same comments would be made by any Prime Minister here in Australia around Medicare. So I suspect that we've got a fairly large fight on our hand if we want to do this. 100% agree that efficiency is the key. But I think there's another way of getting that without necessarily the government stopping funding it, which is the government essentially paying somebody else to manage it. Similar to what the Defence Force has done with Medibank and their system. So they've essentially, they pay Medibank to manage the system, and we have worked through managing the whole system, worked with the department the Defence Department for some efficiencies. So I don't know whether you've thought through that as a possibility. And the other possibility is, doesn't mean that we need to ration care.
I guess against the first one, yeah, you're absolutely right, that could happen. I suppose we were starting from the context of really trying to save the government a lot of money up front, so I guess we weren't considering other ways the government could spend money to improve efficiencies, but that would be a different piece of analysis to be done. Yeah.
So you're right, you can get over the fairness point by just having government pay the premium. And then I guess you get Medicare Select Model, and I guess that was last year's paper. But I guess, I mean, just think about some of the debates we've had in the press over the last, even the last month. So it's sort of outrage that people on high incomes get childcare rebates, or that they get PHI rebates, or that they get a super tax break. And it's not too far to stretch that there could be outrage again that... millionaires get their GP visits paid for by the government. And I guess in that context, some of these scenarios don't look so far-fetched that you could have a headline, well, we're going to take away... well, primary care people, they can sort out their own... people over earning over 100,000, they can sort out their own primary care now, and we're going to save $10 billion over 10 years. You have to make it multiple years to make it more... interesting. And I don't know if that's too far away from the current debate. And then I think that does open up some of these things, that does open up a meaningful pilot for some health insurers to manage some individuals' care in an integrated way. And if they do it well, then who knows? Some of the fear of Medicare Select goes away.
I might actually abuse my own position as chair and ask a question. You showed the pros and cons, the pluses and minuses there for potentially, you know, the private health insurers in the primary care space. Is there evidence for this? Is there actually any evidence out there for that people can rely on?
I'm not sure of the answer to that. I guess... I can put in an early spruik for the next concurrent session where Bronwyn and Joseph are talking about how to evaluate healthcare programs.
Yeah. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it's something that's illegal to do at the moment. So you can't really have so much evidence for it. But I think sort of come back to, it's hard to defend the current system where you don't know your members' health needs necessarily until you get the claim. And you could argue you could do a lot better, A, by knowing about it, and then B, by having a financial incentive to avoid the care, so alignment of the financial interests. So they're both sort of strong incentives for efficiency, and I think they bode well.
Brent Walker, I thoroughly enjoyed your paper, actually. But it caused me to think about a couple of issues. And one is it's good to get the efficiency in terms of health outcomes, I suppose. But would the insurance industry... This is a first question for you. Would the insurance industry be able to manage the primary care part of that we don't look after now as efficiently as it's being managed by Medicare? And I suspect the answer to that would be no. It certainly wasn't the case. We were certainly not very efficient at managing it in the 1970s when we were paying for GP consultations and other primary care services. The other question I've got for you is, what kind of signal would a threshold make to the population who are insured for hospital cover? I'm terribly concerned that the signal would be very much against us, that the papers would say, oh, well, if you've got, you know, if you're earning more than $60,000 a year, say $60,000 was the threshold, or if you're not earning more than $60,000 a year, you don't need private health insurance. And that would cut a lot of our hospital market away from us. You see the point? You know, the threshold would get mixed up and flow across in people's minds anyway to hospital insurance, which would be very painful indeed for the industry.
Yeah, thanks, Brent. I guess you could... I can see your point on thresholds. I can see the point the other way, because I guess we've got thresholds at the moment for MLS purposes. So we still run the adverts about buy... if so you could save tax if you insure, whereas for a lot of people, it's not true. So maybe it'll go the other way. I don't know. I guess on efficiency, I take the point that it's hard to prove we'd be more efficient. I don't know that the current system's that efficient either. It's very efficient at sort of paying for things, but whether it's efficient in getting results, having the GP help people navigate through the health system, going to the right specialists, the most appropriate ones. I don't know. So I guess all we've got to do is be more efficient than the current system as a starting point.
More questions?
Yep. Amanda Aitken from Actuarial Edge. A question for either the panel or anyone in the audience. It sort of touches on your earlier question. Are there examples around the world in different health markets of either private health insurers playing successfully in the primary care market? Or similarly, examples of health insurers causing damage by playing in the primary care market. So a question for anyone that can answer that, I guess.
Opened up to the whole room.
I'll kick it off as I'm closest to a mic, but encourage others to get involved. It's an industry that every country does slightly differently. Primary care is quite a broad group. We were often thinking GPs, I guess specialists would be a good example. I guess I quite like the UK example where if in Australia, if I want a cheap product, I have to buy a product that doesn't cover me for anything. So I can exclude knees or hearts or something like that. In the UK, if I want a cheap product, I buy a product that covers me for everything still, but just restricts my choice a little bit. So if I have a problem, I need some surgery, then I call up my insurer, I call up Bupa, and they would tell me, look, go to one of these free doctors and then go to that hospital and so on. So that's an example of where the insurer is managing more of the process. And because they manage more of the process, they've got some scale buying powers. So that would be my starter to the debate.
Anyone else want to add to that? Did you?
And then we'll have the managed care campaign all over again. Which we had in the past whenever the insurers were started to try and manipulate doctors into doing
the same. I wasn't going to mention the US, but...
it's no surprise that Jamie mentioned the UK, you know.
Andrew Gower again. Just on that last point, though, I don't think the UK has got a large amount of insurers operating in primary care. The NHS is pretty much so self-fulfilling. It's all and sundry, and the private system is much smaller and around the edges. So I'm not sure if that is a great example to quote. The US is obviously much more privatised, but also spends twice as much on healthcare as Australia does. China is a system that I know which spends slightly less, seems to have very similar outcomes. I'd also like to make a comment on one of Brent's points around efficiency. It's interesting that we're using efficiency in two different ways. There's the efficiency in terms of the actual payments, which I think I entirely agree with Brent. I'm not sure if I think we've got a very efficient system as a single system with a single payer to do that. Whereas there's also the efficiency in terms of the health outcomes, which is more where I think the paper's using the term efficiency from. So I think it's probably possibly worthwhile splitting out the efficiency conversation into two different aspects, one in terms of the actual expense efficiency and secondly the health outcome efficiency.
Sorry to take all the questions, but
just to keep going on the minor role point. I mean, we think we have a major role here because half the population's insured and an enormous percentage of elective procedures, private hospital procedures covered by us. And in a number of the health sessions today, we've talked about people have got to see the value in health insurance if they're going to purchase it. Our product is defective in that if you need a medical treatment, so either something's wrong with your knee or you've got cancer or so on, there's a whole series of treatments required from the initial consultation outside hospital, number of visits outside hospital, the surgery piece, and then a number of follow-ups. And our product, it doesn't cover anything outside hospital, and inside hospital you get a gap. And there's tests, there might be gaps on, a whole sequence of gaps. So our product as health insurance is defective because it just covers a small part of that. Whereas, even sticking with the UK example, but I guess most other countries as well that come to mind, the health insurance covers you if you get sick. It covers you for the whole process, right through from initial diagnosis and all your medical expenses in and out. So, if we're to continue to provide a product that's valuable to individuals, including people who buy it just in case, then we need to address this shortcoming in our product, and we need to close that gap there.
Okay, it looks like we get an early mark then. So, please join me in thanking Jamie and Matthew for an interesting presentation and some thought-provoking stuff. Thank you.